All right, I think all the committee members, except for one, is here. So I will. Good morning, everyone. I call the Health and Social Service meeting to order at 10:01 a.m. Today is Monday, December 7th, 2020. We're in the Denali Room in the Anchorage LIO. Today present are myself, Senator Von Imhoff. We have telephonically Senator Diesel, Senator Begich, and we're expecting Senator Schauer. Also online, we have other legislators, Senator Thiel, Senator Gray Jackson, and Representative Drummond are also online. Before we want to start, we just want to thank the staff here today. We have my office, Senator Jasmine Martin, staff to my office. We also have Suzanne Cunningham, legislative liaison to the Department of Health and Social Services. We have our LIO staff, Vanessa helping us out. Chris Dickerell, Senator Records, and the teleconferencer monitors in Juneau today. Today's purpose of the meeting is just an overview of the Department of Health and Social Services on the state's COVID-19 vaccine plan. The intent is just for information dissemination and to learn how the public can be involved and get information, more information, and provide feedback and comments. We're going to ask legislators, committee members, to ask questions after each slide, if they have questions for the presentation, and to ask questions that are relevant to the vaccine, to the presentation before us today on the distribution or the information that's provided today. Before the committee, we have Dr. Ann Zink, our state medical officer on the phone, Director Heidi Hedberg from the Division of Public Health on the phone, Tessa Walker Lindemann, leader of the COVID-19 task force, on the phone. Also, we have Matt Bobo, a DHSS epidemiologist. We have Dr. Robert Anders, medical director at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, on the phone. And also, for questions for if any legislators may have any, we have Director Lori Winghire from the Division of Insurance on the phone to answer any questions about potential insurance questions. And again, this is all part of what we believe Operation Warp Speed from the Trump administration to hurry and get vaccines to us. We may see vaccines in our state very soon, as we will find out and learn. And again, this is not a pro or con discussion of vaccines, but and everyone should consult their medical health care professionals on any risk or importance of taking any vaccines, and this is an all personal choice type of situation. So the committee is not taking a stance one way or the other on vaccines. With that, we will go ahead and start our presentation. I believe we're starting off with Dr. Ann Zink to provide an overview. Dr. Zink, are you with us today?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, we can. And just for review for folks, it's been a while. Just remember to make sure you state your name before you begin to speak as we start to go through the committee, because we're going to hear lots of different voices today. And just state your name for the record and your title. And you may begin when you're ready, Dr. Zink.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. I am Dr. Ann Zink. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska, and honored to be here with you with our team today to talk about where we're at with COVID-19 vaccines in the state of Alaska. We do have a slide presentation, and moving on to slide two, I'll go through a brief overview of what we'll talk about. I'll provide a few opening remarks and talk about briefly about the vaccine candidates, at which point I'll hand it over to Tessa Walker-Linderman, who will talk about the COVID-19 task force, and then turn it over to ANTHC partner, Dr. Bob Anders, to talk about the tribal health partnership work. We'll then go through the different phases and allocations, again, back to Tessa, and talking about ordering, receiving, and distribution, led by our vaccine, immunology program, Matt Bobo. We'll talk some more about communication and community planning with Tessa, and then I'll finish off talking about vaccine confidence, and happy to answer any questions for the committee as we go through. So moving on to the...
Dr. Zink, before you begin, can you hold on one moment or take a brief at ease?
We'll go back on the record here. We are having a bit of a technical difficulty for folks that may be wanting to stream this or watch this live stream. The information, the slides, will be uploaded onto BASIS as well as the presentation. So we just want to let folks know they can go to aklng.gov to watch this at a later time. Go ahead, Dr. Zhang. Sorry for the interruption.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and no problem. So I'm on slide 3, and I'm going to just briefly talk about the current vaccine candidates, although this is a place of a lot of science and a lot of things changing on a quick basis. Moving on to slide 4, I'm going to talk first about the first vaccine that we expect in the state of Alaska, and this is a Pfizer vaccine. So this vaccine has gone through all three stages that are important for vaccine safety as well as efficacy, including phase 1, 2, and 3, and we'll talk about that a bit more later. It's been tested in over 43,000 participants, and it has currently been submitted to the FDA under what's called an emergency use authorization. They are currently reviewing the data for both safety and efficacy, and we are awaiting their conclusions, hopefully early last week. When they looked at their initial data, they found that they had 170 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and when they looked at the placebo group versus those who had received vaccine, they found it was a 95% effective vaccine against COVID-19. After the second dose. I would mention that this efficacy seemed to be consistent across both ages, genders, race, and ethnicity, which was really fantastic to see. And those over 65, it was found to be 94% efficacious. This is a challenging vaccine for logistics. It has to be stored at a negative 70 degrees Celsius for storage, and where our team has been working around the clock to try to make sure that part of the distribution process is well taken care of. Moving on to the next slide, slide 5. This is the second candidate that we expect to be close on the heels of the Pfizer vaccine, and that's the Moderna vaccine. Both of these vaccines are what we call mRNA vaccines. The platform that they use is messenger RNA. They use a very similar process. And this one was found to be very similarly efficacious. So when they looked at their group, which had over 30,000 participants, they saw no serious safety concerns, and they saw 2 weeks post the second dose, it was 94.1% efficacious. And we also saw that against serious COVID disease, it was 100% efficacious. Again, efficacious is how well a vaccine works versus how effective it is how well we all do in getting it out and making sure that people have the vaccine in combination with how effective it is. Excuse me, how efficacious it is. They did submit their information to the FDA and all of their data on December 2nd. They also are starting to do some additional testing in ages 12 through 17. The Pfizer vaccine was only tested in 18 and above. This one's a little bit easier for storage at a negative 20 degrees storage process, and we are also closely working on planning. Moving on to the next slide, this is slide 6 on vaccine candidates. I just really want to stop and pause and emphasize this point. We get asked a lot how we skip steps, why is this going so fast? And it's very important to remember that the vaccines that are coming out have been built on years of technology. mRNA vaccines have been studied for many, many years, and this process has been long underway. They've for a long time found to be very safe, and there's been a lot of technology that's been used to try to make sure that they're efficacious, they work. Both of these vaccines have completed these three phases. So the first phase, phase 1, looks for safety in a small number of people. Excuse me. Phase 2 tests hundreds of people with different characteristics, such as age and health status, to make sure that the side effects are well understood and to begin to look at effectiveness. And then the big bulk of the testing comes in this phase 3, where they test thousands of people for both safety and efficaciousness. And so all three of these steps have been completed and now are being submitted to the FDA for approval. We have a lot more information on different vaccine candidates. There are many more vaccine candidates around the bend. We did have a fantastic presentation by my predecessor, Dr. Jay Butler, and the former Commissioner of Health and Social Services and Chief Medical Officer, who now works as the Deputy Director for the CDC. That was provided to healthcare providers last week. We had over 1,200 healthcare providers tune into that, and that is available for the public to watch as well if people have any questions or concerns. Moving on to the next slide, slide 8. These are our current numbers that we received from the federal government. These have been in flux as we have been looking through different timing and processing, as well as some of the challenges with distribution in the state of Alaska. With the current federal allocations, the state as a total, including IHS beneficiaries, will be getting 35,100 doses. Our current dose information that we have with Moderna is 17,900 doses, although we do expect some changes to that early this week, particularly looking at the IHS distribution. I will comment for the Committee for Awareness, every other state is receiving their allocation in a week-by-week distribution, but the territories were allowed to select upfront allocation given the geographic challenges of administering this vaccine, and we opted for that geographically challenged option where we will get our vaccine for the month upfront. So we will be getting a larger dose upfront instead of week-to-week. And each of these doses really represents people. That's the other thing I want to emphasize. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines require two doses. But when we speak of doses in these terms, we're really speaking of individual people to make sure that we are all consistent on our messaging with the federal government and others. They are holding back that second dose, and then they will send us that second dose when it's time. So this Pfizer 35,100, that's individual people with a second dose coming from behind. We just wanted to make sure that's clear. The other thing that I would mention is that as the FDA is currently looking at this information, a separate independent scientific body called the ACIP is also looking at that information, and they have been sharing. We'll talk a little bit more about allocation a little bit later in the slides. But right now, I'm going to hand it over to Tessa Walker-Lindemann to talk a bit about the task force and how that's structured within the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Okay. Before you do, just wanted to state that Senator Schauer has joined us. Also, Rep. Story and Rep. Hammond has also joined the call as well. And we have a question from Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. And thank you, Dr. Zink, for this presentation. One of the questions that I have for you is the obvious of Pfizer having to be stored at such a cold temperature. I know I've been reading about special cases with dry ice and so forth. Has the state contracted with the university, I think particularly University of Fairbanks? I believe they may have cold storage there. I'm not exactly sure. Have you talked to them at all?
Senator Von Imhoff, to the chair, I appreciate the question. We have been working very extensively on what this looks like, including with UAS and being able to store it. Maybe I will let Tessa Walker-Lindemann talk a little bit more about the details of the storage.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Dr. Zink. And in terms of the ultra cold storage, we have, I feel like I'm hearing some feedback. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you okay, but you just want to state your name for the record?
Oh, sure. Tessa Walker-Lindemann. And so in terms of ultra cold storage, we have located a significant number of ultra cold freezers across the state, and we're working closely with different partners to utilize those freezers. I think it's important to note that the vaccine, the Pfizer has developed a shipping container that can maintain ultra cold temperatures for up to 20 days with dry ice. If it's supplemented with dry ice every 5 days, so we're also utilizing that as well. And so actually over the weekend, we've really been going through this community by community, identifying ultra-cold freezers, making note of the ultra-cold freezer location, figuring out if they've got the dry ice source, and really just making sure what we send to each community is support, I mean, that it can actually maintain that temperature. And so certainly talking to the university, Department of Fish and Game, we're even talking to the Alaska Sea Life Center. So we're really making use of as many ultra-cold freezers as we can find across the state.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions from any other committee members?
Senator Wilson, Senator Schauer, quick question.
Yeah, Senator Schauer.
Thank you for the record, Senator Schauer. If somebody could just answer this, and it's based on slide 8, last paragraph, vaccines made available via an emergency use authorization cannot be required or mandated by governments and businesses. If Dr. Zink or somebody else could answer the question, does that mean that once the EUA has been eliminated or we've moved on to where that's no longer applicable, that would read that then the state, for example, could mandate the vaccine. Would that be a true statement?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I appreciate that question. We are currently being told that it would probably be approximately 2 years of data before they would finish the EUA, before they would do a full authorization. But private businesses can mandate individual vaccines once they have a full authorization, such as the influenza vaccine. Currently, at this time, the state has no plans to mandate any vaccine And currently no private businesses can mandate a vaccine under an EUA authorization. Does that answer your question, sir?
It does, Senator Wilson. Thanks for that. I just was, there was a kind of a reason for it that was related to my other job as a cargo pilot, because there is concerns for certain groups that they may be mandated, and we're seeing a confliction of data where the FAA, for example, is saying that if the pilot takes the vaccine right now because it hasn't been approved, in other words, we're not quite sure, you know, how all this shakes out, but then we would lose our license and couldn't have a, you know, wouldn't be able to fly, or, and this will apply to other jobs. So I guess I'm just trying to get some clarification as we go through this on how it will impact various people, depending on, you know, critical workforce, critical infrastructure, and others, how this may or may not play out. Senator Wilson, we can answer that later. I'm just trying to figure out an answer for a lot of folks who are getting these questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. All right. Hearing no other questions, you may continue. I believe we are on slide number 10, talking about the task force.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. My name is Tessa Walker-Linderman. I'm a nurse consultant for the Division of Public Health and the DHS lead for the COVID Vaccine Task Force. So on this, on slide 10, you can see just a rough breakdown of the our organization chart for our the Alaska COVID Vaccine Task Force. This group was convened in August of this year as we began hearing more and more about vaccine clinical trials. And really, as this group was put together, we realized very quickly it was going to be important to be partnering with our tribal partners. And so, as you can see here, there's actually a co-lead for myself with ANTHC, and then actually within every team that you see beneath here, we have a co-lead from DHSS and then a co-lead from ANTHC. And so within each of these teams below, you can see we've got planning, operations, software solutions, payers, pharmacy, education and communication, data and liaisons. And each of these teams really is broken down even further with sub-teams. And so really our task force is about 50 people, and we are meeting daily, and we have significant work that we're doing. We'll talk a little bit more about what this looks like on the community level, but we're working closely with our ANTHC partners, which I will now turn over to Dr. Bob Anders to discuss the tribal partnership.
Thank you. This is Robert Anders. I'm the medical director for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and interim Alaska Native Medical Center administrator. I appreciate the committee's having this hearing. Unfortunately, I have to leave here at 10:30, but we'll be here briefly if there are questions. I'd like to express my appreciation to the state of Alaska for involving ANTHC very early on in the planning process. The tribal health system at the state likely has more vaccine point of administrations than any other entity across the state when you combine over 180 village clinics and multiple hospitals. And these endpoints for potential vaccine administration not only serve Alaska Native people, but serve in many locations all beneficiaries in those communities. To involve us early in the planning process, I think, has been instrumental in helping us plan for distribution to kind of the more challenging areas across the state. I think the partnership has worked really well, and like Tessa noted, there are partners with ANTHC across all the different areas within that org chart. We help coordinate as needed with the state of Alaska with our regional tribal health partners and tribes and facilitate those discussions. And I believe using the existing infrastructure that the state has for vaccine administration and immunization coordination, this will help facilitate the process working well across the state. So thank you again. I'm happy to answer questions. I apologize for having a conflict and having to leave a little early. Thank you.
All right, we can move to slide 12. This is Tessa Walker-Linderman again, talking about the phases and allocation of vaccine.
slide 13, we have a timeline of some of the quick-moving parts of vaccine over this last week and the coming weeks. On December 1st, the CDC Advisory Council on Immunization Practices, ACIP, met and voted on recommendations for who will receive vaccine first. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. On December 3rd, the Alaska Allocation Committee met to recommend what that would look like specific to Alaska. So we had the federal guidelines, and then we went more to an Alaska-specific level with our Alaska Allocation Committee. Over this past weekend, December 4th through 7th, we've been really working through the vaccine shipment details, including estimated doses to be reported to hospital leadership and hospital vaccine centers. Those emails went out this morning. On December 10th, this Thursday, FDA will be meeting to discuss the Pfizer vaccine EUA application, and additional CDC guidance is expected. If the EUA is approved, vaccine shipments may begin.
Ms. Walker, we're going to take an at ease here.
Okay.
We apologize for a technical difficulty we were experiencing. We are on slide 13, and again, for members of the public, these slides are uploaded on our bases. For folks of the public who may want to follow along with a presentation at AKLEG, and you can find the committee What's Happening Now tab and find the slides there. With that,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Begich?
Yeah, I had a question that I wanted to ask earlier, Mr. Chairman. Can I ask it very quickly now?
Yes, please.
My question relates to the earlier presentation about the two vaccines, and it's sort of twofold, but it's I'm just wondering what the time gap might be between the first and second dose of either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine, and also if the second dose must be administered in order to achieve the efficacy that was described earlier.
Yes, I just wanted to make sure, and that may be coming a little bit later in the slide deck. Just wanted to double check, but yes, Dr. Zink, if you're able to answer that.
Yes, thank you, Senator Begich, through the chair. I appreciate that question. So both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are both two-dose allocations, so it's really important people get both, and they get the same vaccine type that they got the first time. So the Moderna vaccine is split a month apart, 28 days apart, and the Pfizer vaccine is split 3 weeks apart, 21 days apart. The efficacy looks to really pick up after that second dose, and so it's very important that people not only get their first dose, but they do get that second dose of vaccine, which is one of the logistical challenges that we're trying to really ensure that Alaskans know that they need to get to, plan their life around getting that second dose, and make sure they get their second dose of vaccine to really achieve the efficacy that we saw. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Thank you, Senator Begich. With that, Lindman Walker, you may continue. Walker, Lindman,
thank
sorry.
You. That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to continue on slide 13, we anticipate that in mid-December, Pfizer vaccine shipments will arrive in Alaska, which really would be potentially next week. So we are working hard to be ready for that. And then in mid to end December is when we expect Moderna vaccine shipments to arrive in Alaska. And as Dr. Zink mentioned before, we are receiving our vaccine doses up front, and this will continue each month throughout 2021. See, on slide 14, is highlighting that vaccine availability will be within phases. And so federally, you may hear lots of conversation about phase one, phase two, and phase three. And basically what this means is that, initially in phase 1A, that there will be very limited availability, and then we'll move on to phase 1B. And then the phase two is when we will be receiving more regular shipments, and then when it's widely available is when it will be open to the entire population, when there's more vaccine potentially than people who still need to get it. And so this We don't have an exact timeline on this yet, but we are very, very close to being in phase 1A, as I said, potentially just 1 week or so out. So it will be exciting to see us progress through this timeline. On the next slide, for slide 15, so how vaccine is allocated. This has been of high interest to everyone as we've been waiting to find out who will receive vaccine first. And so the CDC Advisory Council on Immunization Practices approved the following recommendation by a majority vote at its December 1st, 2020 emergency meeting. And they indicated that the initial phase of COVID vaccine should be offered to healthcare personnel and residents of long-term care facilities. And so this does get broken down into significant more detail, but in terms of just the initial, the two initial groups that were selected for initial vaccine. Further, CDC,
I'm sorry, go ahead and finish. Before we move on to slide, we have a question.
Okay. I just moved to slide 16, but I can pause.
Oh, yes. So I guess if you can define sort of more into the healthcare personnel or how many healthcare personnel we're talking about. We're talking about all healthcare personnel in the state of Alaska, so your dermatologist, pathologist, or just the critical care workers that are dealing with frontline COVID.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And actually on slide 16 is when we really break that down into more detail. So I can move through slide 16, and if you need additional clarification, then I can do that after this slide. So further CDC recommendations, they included that within healthcare personnel that they had direct patient contact. So these would be healthcare workers that are unable to telework. It would be those, including those who work in inpatient, outpatient, and community settings, and then that they provide services to patients or patients' family members, or that they handle infectious materials. They also noted healthcare personnel working in residential care or long-term care facilities, and also healthcare personnel infected with COVID-19 within the preceding 90 days may choose to delay vaccination for other healthcare personnel more susceptible to infection, and that there is no current data to inform recommendations for pregnant or breastfeeding women. And I think in subsequent slides, then we even continue to talk more in more detail about the Alaska Allocation Committee. So if there are additional questions about the allocation, I think that they may be answered as we continue through these slides. So I will pause at the end of the allocation discussion, and we can answer questions specific to that then, if that is okay.
Yes, please continue.
Okay. On slide 17, the ACIP also further sub-prioritized long-term care facility residents, including skilled nursing facilities. And then after skilled nursing facilities, they included assisted living facilities, intermediate care facilities for individuals with developmental disabilities, residential care facilities, and state veteran homes. And then next slide, on slide 18. So I just went through what the federal allocation said. And so really, as we've been thinking through this, and this is really something that Dr. Zink has used often, is to talk about the nesting doll approach to this, and that really we, in our largest nesting doll is the federal recommendations. And then you move down to the next doll, and it's the Alaska Allocation Committee. And then even within that next doll is how, you know, potentially a hospital or a community might be prioritizing. And then as you move your way down, ultimately it gets down to the individual level making that choice for themselves. And so I know there's lots of questions about allocation. And as we kind of move through this, you know, we're talking about the federal one, I'll talk about the state. But even then, there's prioritization that is being continued throughout these different layers. So next slide, on slide 19, I'll talk about the Alaska Allocation Committee. So on December 3rd, the Alaska COVID-19 Vaccine Allocation Committee met and unanimously determined a portion of groups that will be included in phase 1A. And so they really broke these out into several different tiers. And so tier one is the hospital-based frontline healthcare workers at highest risk for COVID-19 infection, and then also long-term care facility residents and staff. Then within Tier 2, they included our EMS and then fire personnel providing EMS services, community health aides, and individuals who are required to perform vaccinations. So this was Tier 2. That being said, within our entire December allocation of vaccine, we have more vaccine than than is needed for these two tiers. And so the allocation committee will be meeting again this Thursday to discuss inclusion of additional groups into phase 1A.
All right, thank you. Ms. Walker-Linderman, also for all presenters, there seems to be a sound issue with hearing you in another LIO. So if you're on speakerphone, we just ask if you don't talk on speakerphone while you're talking into the while you're presenting. And also, just if you can answer the question, I guess, that I had on the number of hospital workers that the vaccine allocation for this first phase 1A would address.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the question. And the critical number, the number of hospital workers that our hospitals have identified is their critical number, is their number of critical hospital workers for their hospitals was around 8,000. And so then they let us know that their staff overall was around 14,000. And so those are the numbers that we are basing our allocation to hospitals off of.
Thank you. And Sandra Von Ishmael, then we'll go to Sandra Begich.
Thank you. So the question that I have is, you mentioned earlier on one of your slides that if healthcare workers tested positive within preceding 90 days, they may choose to delay the vaccination. Is it for folks who actually have either had the know that they've had the COVID virus at some point this year, or they get the antibody test and they have antibodies in their system, do you recommend that they get the vaccine, or are they in essence already vaccinated naturally just by going through the process of having the virus and fighting it off naturally?
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff, and I will ask Dr. Zink to answer that question.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. It's been Von Imhoff through the chair. Yeah, so it's a fantastic question. We have been waiting for CDC and ACIP additional guidance. The initial data shows that the immunity you get from vaccination is stronger and more clean than it is from natural immunity in most cases. And so at this point, we are anticipating that people who have recovered from COVID-19 will be getting vaccinated per their choice. As you mentioned, there may be providers who choose to delay for all sorts of different reasons. And as Tessa mentioned, all the way moving down into those smaller groups of kind of bundling nesting dolls, there may be people who choose. But we are offering vaccine within that phase 1A, tier 1, tier 2 group, including those who have recovered. And we are not asking for antibody testing prior to vaccination because the lack of data to show kind of how much immunity is really held just with the antibody test itself. It's a more complex process than just what is represented by the antibody test. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Through the chair.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate that. I'm actually, those studies are just now coming out about whether the vaccine versus natural immunity is as effective or have different efficacy rates. I have articles that actually show the vaccine, while 94-95% is effective, but natural immunity in the people that they've been studying is more like 97-98. So I think it is too early to really determine whether one or the other is better, and whether you've had it, you should have it again. At least that's the reading that I'm getting, and I just think that it's this is Operation Warp Speed, literally, and just the data that's coming out. So I do like, just last comment, is that you definitely have prioritized, hospital frontline workers and so forth, and then you did leave the ability for people who have had it to maybe delay a little bit just to see what the studies are coming out. So, I mean, I do appreciate that caveat in the presentation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senator Giesel. Could I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Geisel, we're in line here for Senator Baggage, and then right after Senator Baggage, we'll go to Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator Wilson. Through the chair, to either of the presenters, you said that there may be an excess amount of vaccine available for your Tier 1A folks here, and I noticed that you list EMS and fire personnel. I'm just curious if in your consideration of potentially who you might extend that to, you're thinking of law enforcement or other first responders. And if not, could you consider them?
Yes, thank you, Senator Baggage, through the chair. I appreciate that question. You know, as Senator Von Imhoff had mentioned, there are going to be individual choices, and we continue to watch the science and data very closely on this. And we do have regular healthcare provider echoes as well as vaccine echoes to make sure that people have the most recent information regarding COVID vaccine and what is happening. As we work through how many people are willing to get the vaccine, are ready to get the vaccine, we'll continue to work through those. As you mentioned, law enforcement, our critical infrastructure workforce that are highly important to our society, and they do have a lot of potential exposure, and that is part of the questions that both the ACIP committee as well as our state allocation committee are taking up here both this week and next week, and so we'll continue to follow that closely. And we'll continue to work with them, honestly, on a week-to-week basis as we see kind of what the uptake looks like, what the distribution looks like. Kind of our pillars of vaccine distribution are to make sure that it is science-based, that it's equitable and logistically feasible. And so as we get vaccine in, we continue to work through all three of those pillars to make sure that no vaccine is wasted, and making sure that we are trying to promote the health and well-being of Alaskans as efficiently as possible. So appreciate the question.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, if I could just a follow-up related to the sequencing here.
Yes, Senator Baggage.
And so my other just sort of related question is, I know you mentioned earlier nursing homes, which I think nursing home populations, which I think were 1B. And I'm just, where does our homeless population fall in this process, or have you considered that?
Thank you, Senator Baggage, through the chair. This is Dr. Ann Zink again. Yes, as you mentioned previously, nursing homes, long-term care facilities, skilled nursing facilities are all within that very early phase 1A. Regarding the homeless population, that's a more challenging population, particularly with the required of needing a two-dose vaccine. And so we are currently in discussion right now on exactly the timing of that group. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Could you keep my office, please, Mr. Chairman, through the chair? Could you please keep my office informed on the progress on that second issue? I would appreciate that.
Thank you.
Senator Baggage, through the chair. Absolutely. And I would like to just emphasize, we also have a task force working with COVID challenges, particularly with the homeless population, including a physician dedicated to that. So I will make sure that they are looped into your office and we keep you up to date as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also, Dr. Zink, I know that you have a lot of information that you want to disseminate, but if you could slow down a little bit. You're speaking a little fast for some of the folks to follow that are listening in. Also want to recognize that we have a couple other legislators listening in and watching. Senator Stevens, also Rep. Edgman has been on for a while, and Rep. Johnson. Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for Dr. Zink. I want to go back to Senator Von Imhoff's question related to the immunity that develops from natural infection or the vaccine itself, Dr. Zink. And by the way, just parenthetically, thank you for all those ECHO meetings that you have hosted or been part of. They've been very helpful. But one of the questions I haven't heard addressed on those is this COVID, the coronavirus family is a very diverse family. And what we call the common cold is part of that family. And we all know that we can get a cold in January and get another one in February. So that there are multiple members of the family of coronavirus. I have seen some data that the coronavirus, the COVID-19 virus has mutated several times, has different varieties. what data are you looking at? What is the U.S. following in terms of what specific variety of COVID-19 is circulating in our country? Are there different strains that are in different parts of the country? And what do we actually know about that? Thank you.
Yes, Senator Giesel, through the chair, I appreciate that question. We do watch closely on what we call different clads or slightly different variations between this specific virus, SARS-CoV-2, that causes COVID-19. We have been submitting some genomic sequencing to the genetic sequencing data bank that is particularly done at the Fairbanks laboratory and has been very involved in a process since the very beginning. We have seen six of the seven major clads circulating through Alaska that have been circulating in the U.S. as a whole. I would mention that all of these vaccines really appear to be targeting the spike protein, which is, that protein that sticks off of this virus, and that's how it enters into the cell. And the shape and function of that does not appear to be changing at all with these clads. And so the vaccines appear to be consistent regardless of the slight changes that we're seeing in the COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19. So we are optimistic about the fact that all of these vaccines appear to be hitting a target that does not change, that has been stable and is essential for this virus to enter the human cell. And so they should be effective even as it continues to change, but we'll continue to watch that closely, particularly as the additional pressure is put on this virus with vaccine development. Regarding immunity, there is a ton of information coming out about this. We get the most information about side effects for vaccines really within the first two months. That's when we see most side effects, but how long the immunity lasts really is determined after about 6 months of data. And so we're just starting to get into that for the phase three trials. It also appears that the virus that causes COVID affects both the innate immunity as well as the responsive immunity, so both looking at antibodies and T cells and germinal centers, numerous aspects of the immune response, and lots of data coming out about that. We'll continue to follow that regularly and make sure healthcare providers, people within the state of Alaska have that information, and we continue to follow that very closely. We're also very excited to see the raw data being released both from the ACIP and the FDA once they've finished their initial review, and then I'm sure there will be lots of people looking at that, lots of information shared, and we will continue to look at that data as well. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zink. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I have a question back on slide 14. When we talk about the availability and phases, and this comes from a variety of folks that have contacted our office and just want to know some clarity on terms of, obviously we're in phase A, the very phase A, 1A. Can you go into sort of phase 2, phase 3 of who might those folks be, where teachers may fall in the line? We have other public officials who've just got, sort of diagnosed with COVID, where they may fit in the line. And just where other essential workers may fit as well in terms of sort of the phases.
Thank you for that question. Through the chair, this is Matthew Bobo. I am the immunization program manager for the state of Alaska. And in terms of how these phases will work, in phase 1A, as we mentioned, that's healthcare workers and long-term facility residents. Then phase 1B, we will be looking at critical workforce. There are a lot of guidelines out by the federal government about those critical workforce members. So those would include those teachers as well as other individuals. And that will be kind of mapped out through the allocation committee. Phase 2 is really making sure that we're working through that critical workforce, and then we're moving into the general population. And then phase 3, there will be sufficient supply, and then that would be the general population.
And how would the general public or folks of interest be able to provide input to the allocation committee? As our understanding is that the guidelines are for, from the federal government, and then each state sort of can sort of help decide who's initiated into those phases. And so just didn't know if you're taking sort of stakeholder input and how that stakeholder input could be put into sort of who might be essential workers might be decided upon.
I appreciate that question, Senator, through the chair. Matt Bobo, I don't know if you want to comment on that specifically, or I'm happy to talk about the process.
I will let you talk, Dr. Zink. Thank you so much.
Okay, sounds good. So we do have an allocation committee, and people are welcome to send letters into the allocation committee. It's important that the allocation committee is not an advocacy committee. They are a group of scientists and clinicians who represent a diverse range of expertise and experiences across the state, both in rural and urban areas, including a medical ethicist, and they are there to be able to look at the information, again, with those pillars of science, logistics, as well as equity across the state. But they do they get letters all the time talking about different groups sharing their experience, critical infrastructure workers, the general population and public sharing their thoughts and opinions. It's helpful for us to get different people's thoughts and opinions, and we do share that with them. And then our communication team also looks at that as well and make sure that they reach out to those groups specifically. Thank you.
And do you have a way that we can contact, or folks that may be listening may want to write those letters to the allocation committee? Is that information on the DHSS website?
Chairman, yes, so we do have some additional information. We can give you the names of our liaison, including Shelley Grigsby, as well as Desiree Chambers, and that is also at the end of our slide presentation. We'll be able to have that information for you.
Thank you. All right. I believe we are on slide 20.
Senator Wilson?
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. It's hard to do that. I can't raise your hand. So two questions for Dr. Zink, I believe. The first one is, and this is more for explaining exactly how the efficacy of this particular vaccine works. Does it reduce your chance of, or eliminate your chance of catching COVID and transmitting it, or is it only something that will reduce the severity of your symptoms if you were to come in contact with the virus itself after getting the vaccine?
Thank you, Senator Scherer. Through the chair, that's a fantastic question. So the initial data was really looking at those who were symptomatic from COVID. So it was looking at the severity as well as those who were presenting with symptoms, and that's where the efficacy was found. They are still looking at the data about if you could potentially get COVID-19 and transfer it to other people, and we don't have that data as of yet. So we're expecting more information on that to see about your ability to give the virus to others. Most of the data was on symptoms, particularly severe symptoms. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the second question, if I may.
Yes, Senator Schauer.
Thank you. And it's a little more ephemeral, Dr. Zink, but just it seems like the goalpost has kind of moved a little bit. I get that that's what's happened as this virus has, as we've learned more, as it's continued, the spikes, et cetera, you know, from flattening the curve to keeping the hospitals empty to just until we get a vaccine, now until enough people get a vaccine, it just keeps morphing on us. The reason I ask, and there's only so much of this you can answer, but I'm asking it more for you for the timeline. I wanted to wait until I'd seen the allocation plan and how you briefed it and when we can sort of expect it. But it definitely ties into our economy and the, you know, virtual destruction of a good portion of our small businesses, especially that had, they just can't survive. And we see, for example, in Anchorage where they're shutting down the economy again for many small businesses and their ability to survive. So when I think about the impacts from where the goalposts are moving until we get to a point where enough people are comfortable that we can open the economy back up, do you have a feel for where we would reach an appropriate threshold? Because, you know, like I said, we've already lost a lot of businesses, and this does have a direct impact. So purely from the medical point of view, when do you think we would reach a number, as I hear you're saying, you know, but this may be until late next year. I mean, there's no way, you know, we're going to survive this economically if we keep pushing the goalposts back. How far until we get to a point where, from a medical perspective, we can stop doing this and making it where the economic impacts are almost, well, I would contend are worse than the disease based on what's happening. Can you give us an idea what you think we might get to when that would be something you could even advise the governor and say it's time, if that makes sense as a question? I know that's a tough one, but thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for indulging me on that.
Thank you, Senator Schauer, through the chair. It's a fantastic question. And, you know, in DHSS, our mission is the health and well-being of Alaskans. And we know that that is not only physical health, but that is mental health. And we know that people's economic health is closely tied to both their economic or their physical health as well as their mental health. The tools at reducing the spread of COVID-19 are really tools to keep businesses open and to keep people healthy and safe and moving forward, as well as to keep the systems of our government in place. Schools open, hospitals functioning, law enforcement being able to do their job without people being sick and without people overwhelming any one part of the system. And so all of those things are incredibly important, and our team continues to look at all of the different components of health and well-being well outside of COVID. People hear a lot about us from COVID, but we are continuing to look at all of those other aspects as well. The goal from the beginning continues to be to make sure that the general systems of government are able to function, that hospitals don't become overwhelmed, that kids are being able to be educated, that law enforcement is able to do their job, and continue to move along those lines. We continue to build tools to be able to help that. The beginning of this pandemic, we had very few tools. We didn't have the ability to test. We didn't know much about this virus. It was hard to see where it was going and what was happening. And as we've built those tools, those have been built in to our response. And so we've been able to take care of a lot more patients than we were able to before. We've been able to see patients do much better than they were prior to it. We've been able to identify cases sooner, able to contact trace and isolate so that people are not spreading it unknowingly to others. And that it continues to be the goal. The vaccine is an additional tool within that, to make sure that we are protecting those who are most vulnerable and to make sure those systems are in place. So, for example, being able to immunize residents of long-term care facilities, skilled nursing facilities, that not only helps to protect them, but then those are the people who most likely need hospitalization. Those are the people who then start to kind of build up within the hospital system. We also require a lot of testing and additional resources. And so if we're able to protect them, not only are they able to be protected, but we can then pivot and allocate resources to things like schools and being able to pivot towards being able to have faster turnaround for other areas, as we just really do have a finite limit of resources. So I would say from my perspective, the goalpost has always been the same, and that's the health and well-being of Alaskans, and that is making sure that these general systems of government stay functional and moving forward that promote the health and well-being, and a vaccine is an effective and useful tool within that and continue to move along those lines. I hope that answers your question, but happy to take more. Thank you, sir.
Senator Wilson, a quick follow-up?
Yes, Senator Schauer?
Yes, Dr. Zink, thanks. Long answer. That's okay. I know there's lots to this. I should have been a little more specific. And this is for the public that is listening and wondering when they're going to be able to, you know, because that sounds good. However, if I'm a small business, having to operate at 25% capacity, I can't survive that. That's what's already happened to many of our small businesses. So from a point of being able to give something to the public where they might be able to go, oh, at about this point, maybe we can look for relief, or we're going to be good enough from a medical perspective from what the state would say or what you might recommend to the governor, say, it's time, we're good enough to move forward. If you can't take a guess and you're not willing to, that's fine. I accept that. But if you could, if you were able to, would you say in 2 months we'll be good based on the information you have today with this brief, and 3 months and 6 months, when do you think we will be at a point where we can truly open up the economy to all sectors, not just certain sectors? I hope that makes more sense. I was looking, if you can't be definitive, that's fine, but that's kind of what I was looking for. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Schauer, through the chair. I can be sort of definitive, and I guess I would say, you know, when we don't see a lot of COVID spreading, it's really easy to have people being able to mix and to get together. We see COVID primarily spreading when we're indoor spaces, when we can't have a mask, and we can't distance. We see many communities, particularly in the Southeast, that have had low numbers and are functioning quite open, but we see places when we get a lot of cases that require additional mitigation steps. Regarding vaccine and vaccine distribution, I'm describing it a lot like the sun. I think initially on the 22nd, you won't notice a big difference from the 21st. But come the spring equinox, we will be getting, I think, a lot more vaccine out. And on summer solstice, we notice that the world is very different, and I think the world would be different with vaccines as well. There's a lot of ifs to that, and making sure that there's no production challenges, continuing to watch the science fully. But honestly, from my seat in this position, it feels like watching a man land on the moon to see the science come together such quick time over vaccines, and to see the hope and inspiration right now. I feel like we can see the runway up ahead, and it's going to be a lot of work in the next few months. But I think this spring and summer are going to feel like very different places, not because of any rules or regulation, but because we're not going to be having as many people sick and effective infected by COVID-19, which is directly impacting their ability to function and work and to keep businesses open and moving forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Zay. Like I said, I think we're back on slide 20.
Thank you, sir. So this is about the ordering and distribution of the vaccine, and I believe that Matt Bobo will be taking this next section.
Hello, this is Matthew Bobo. I am the Immunization Program Manager, and I am responsible in terms of the task force operations. So we're on slide 20. It's ordering, receiving, distributing vaccine. And then we'll move to slide 21. You should see a map of the picture of the state of Alaska. So Alaska has an existing system to get vaccines from the manufacturer all the way to the most rural parts of our state. So the map that you see depicts actually all of the sites that we distribute vaccines for the Federal Vaccines for Children program, as well as the Alaska Vaccine Assessment Program. Next slide. On slide 22, COVID-19 vaccination providers may enroll in the CDC COVID-19 vaccination program administered by the Alaska Immunization Program. And that's a program within the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is a link to where providers can get more information about specifics of that program. As of December the 4th, we have had 265 healthcare providers that are fully enrolled in the COVID-19 vaccination program. Next slide, please. We have an integrated IT systems that are both public and private, as well as new and existing, and they are needed to ensure successful vaccine allocation, distribution, administration, monitoring, and reporting. An example of one of those systems is the Immunization Information System, which is called VacTrack. A lot of providers have experience using VacTrack, and we will be introducing a few new systems to help with the tracking and monitoring of vaccines.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Begich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a very quick question. I just read this week about some concerns about the hacking of IT systems for distribution. Are we taking precautions in regards to that?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, yes. Security and IT are very important to us, and we do have a security plan for our VacTrack system, and it's behind firewalls, and that is being assessed and talked about throughout this whole entire process. And we're definitely having our security officers and all of the conversations with our federal partners.
So, Mr. Chairman, just a brief follow-up.
Yes, Senator Begich.
So you are communicating with them about that particular hack that was reported, and they're sharing real-time information with you?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, I am personally not, I don't know of what this exact case is, but we are following security and making sure that there are no hacks, and our security officers are involved in just making sure that our system is up to date. But there have been no hacks, and we are definitely making sure that everything is secure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Bobo.
Thank you. So we're on slide 24. We have been told by the federal government that jurisdictions are not advised to purchase ultra-cold storage equipment at this time. The vaccine, the ultra-cold vaccine, will be direct shipped from the manufacturer, that is Pfizer, in coolers. These coolers are called thermal shippers, and they're packed with dry ice, and they also contain a continuous recording thermometer. The direct shipments to the vaccination providers will be 975 dose increments on a real-time day-to-day basis, and we'll be making sure that we're tracking those packages and making sure that providers are getting them. And next slide, community planning.
All right, thanks, Matt. This is Tessa Walker-Linderman, and I will talk through some of our community planning. So slide 26. So really, at DHSS, our vaccine task force in general is really focused on the planning for phase 1A, as we mentioned earlier in the slide, so that our communities can really be focused on subsequent phases of planning. And so we have developed a team of regional technical assistance advisors, which we're calling TAAs, and we're really leaning on our preparedness public health nurses to serve as the TAAs to different regions across the state. Next slide. On slide 27, you can see that some of the responsibilities of our TAAs are to assess community planning process, progress, provide individualized outreach and support, provide updated information, assist with problem solving and providing resources, engage in regular communication, and ultimately we really are wanting to support the community's planning efforts for subsequent phases of vaccine distribution. And then on slide 28, you can just see some of the partners that our TAAs are helping to pull together in communities, from the public health senator, looking at emergency management and preparedness, local government, tribal leadership, hospitals. I won't go through all of them. You can read the slide, but just so you're all aware, the level of really robust planning that we are hoping to support on the community level. And again, our TAAs are there as a support, but really looking to the communities to provide that that level of planning for their community. On the next slide, you can just see the different regions that we have TAAs. We have South Central, Interior, Southeast, Northern, and then the municipality of Anchorage has their own TAA. So I think for various communities, I know that our TAAs are reaching out really on a Bureau of Census area level and really coordinating that planning with each of their identified areas. And now we will talk about vaccine confidence and turn it back over to Dr. Zink.
Yes, thank you. This is Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer. Just a few last slides here. The last one is about just vaccine confidence, and really appreciate the Senate having this hearing today to be able to share with the public and ask really important questions about vaccines. Our goal is to be transparent and timely with our information and make sure that we are sharing with Alaskans and with Alaskan decision makers the latest information that we have, not only at this hearing, but on an ongoing basis, because we know that while there may be efficacious vaccines, again, it needs to be effective by making sure that it gets out to people who it's right to get out for. Moving on to slide 31, we continue to have public service announcements. Here's one that talks a little bit about testing and production. That came from the CDC. We are also working on local production of additional information and working a lot with communities to make sure that we can answer direct questions. Going to the next slide, we do have a COVID vaccine website. This is covidvax.alaska.gov. We also have our regular communications, including weekly emails and written messages, and you can sign up for those. There's multiple learning opportunities, including every Thursday at 2 p.m. We have a publicly available Echo. We have been using these Echoes throughout the COVID response. They are very helpful for us to have two-way communication with the Alaskan public to hear what's working and what's not working well and what questions that they have, as well as to share the information from our team to make sure that Alaskans are empowered with the same information and knowledge that we have, and we share the same information there that we share with you all and policymakers across the state. So appreciate all those who can turn in. And then continue to work with healthcare stakeholders and other community partners with planning resources. And so with that, Senator, that is the end of our presentation. We do have a few slides at the end with some additional resources that we wanted to make sure the team was had and had available, but happy to take any questions. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. I'm just going to start off with a question here as folks online get ready to unmute. Cost of the vaccine and who is paying for the vaccine?
So appreciate that question, Chairman. Matt Bellow, do you want to take that?
Sure. Thank you for the question. Through the chair, This vaccine has been funded through Operation Warp Speed, and there is no cost to the public for the vaccine. It is covered by the federal government. Providers are being allowed to charge an administration fee for giving that vaccine, and that has been worked through with insurance companies.
Right. And how long does that funding will last or expected to last? Are we talking about through all the phases or next year or just until funds run out?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, for my understanding from the federal government that this will be through phase 1A, B, 2, and 3. I'm not sure after that what this will look like.
All right. Thank you. We'll go to anyone, senators on the line that have questions? I have about 19 of them, so.
Senator Wilson, Senator Schauer, quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just a quick clarification, I think, probably for Dr. Zink. Just writing notes, I'm trying to follow along with the briefing. But if I go back to one question, just to make sure, if you take the vaccine but still could potentially catch COVID, and I think it was Senator Giesel's question that talked about different strains, et cetera, and I was following your answer, would you still be considered I think I know the answer for what you said, but I want to clarify. Would you still be considered contagious even if you had taken the vaccine and then somehow catch it? I know that sounds like a weird question, but I want to be really clear for how this may impact these questions lead to people, whether they're going to be told they have to take the vaccine to work, et cetera. So based on what you know today of the vaccine and how the virus works, what category would they be in?
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Through the chair, unfortunately, we don't fully know the answer to that question as of yet. These trials were designated, and their initial endpoints were looking at severe disease. But the question you bring up is a tremendously important one that is being asked right now to try to see what sort of impact that would have on the ability to share the disease, to spread it from one person to the other. We see some vaccines that really prevent that ability to spread it from one person to another, and we see others that really just minimize your symptoms. We are hoping to have additional information shortly on that, but unfortunately we don't have the science and data to be able to comment fully backed up with that information as of yet, but we'll share that as soon as we have additional information.
Thank you, Senator Wilson.
All right. Well, I'll go ahead with the next question here. I guess sort of following off on Senator Schauer's question, if someone has the vaccine, takes the first shot, gets COVID, are they to continue well for the second shot of the vaccine?
So, Senator, I appreciate that question. At this time, we will have additional information that comes out with the EUA if someone develops symptoms. We are really waiting for that kind of sheet that goes with your vaccines, which many of you are aware of, and we're hoping to have more clarity specifically on that. In general, we do not encourage people to get vaccines while they're actively sick just because their immune system is spent fighting time, fighting that disease. But we are looking forward to that official EUA and where we are expecting much more clarity on that question here within the next week and a half. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. And many of these questions are questions that after we posted the hearing request, our office was sort of inundated with some questions. So we're just asking these questions on behalf of the public. But I don't want to hog up the time, but I don't know if Senator Giesel or Senator Begich have any questions.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Begich.
Just back on that last slide about the materials that you have, are those available in other languages as well? In my district alone, there's over 100 languages spoken, so I'm just curious if in what sort of formats the information is available.
Thank you for the question through the chair. This is Tessa Walker-Linderman, and we are working on getting all the resources provided in different languages. The CDC also has a significant number of languages. Their documents are provided in different languages as well. As Dr. Zink has been saying, that specific to the EUA and some of the actual resources that will go with the vaccine once we have all the information, they haven't been printed or developed, or you know, we don't have access to them just yet, but our communications team is it's been one of our top priorities to make sure we have contracts in place so that as soon as we get those resources, we can translate them into languages that are necessary for that, so that Alaskans can utilize these resources.
Thank you very much for that answer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Schauer.
Yes, Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two more questions, I think, again, for Dr. Zink. One, I was speaking to an individual last week that is involved in the vaccine production in the lower 48. One of the things I was told was that they believe, and it's kind of leading to my earlier question about timeline and how long we're going to stretch this out, the economic impacts and other things, but that they have to get a certain amount of the population vaccinated inside of about 6 months, or based on mutations and efficacy and other things, it kind of falls off the cliff and you have to start over. I was wondering if you could comment to that and what you know of how it might work in Alaska, or what you've heard of that, because obviously that's a bit distressing if we, you know, have to stretch this out until we have enough based on the third wave, if you will, of open to the general population. Second question, so I don't have to interrupt the chairman again, as I've had, based on his point of a lot of constituents that have asked questions about religious exemptions, is that still going to be something that the state is going to honor for those that don't want to get the vaccine? Because there's certainly a lot of people that either are afraid, you know, of how new or how fast it's been rushed, et cetera. I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the exemption categories for certain people that, for various reasons, do not wish to take the vaccine. Those are the two questions. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Senator Schauer, through the chair. Great questions. I'll start with the exemption question first. The state has no intention of mandating the vaccine. Religious exemption or other reasons that people wish to not get the vaccine, that is their choice to make, and the state chooses to honor that. There's no intention to force people to get the vaccine. Our goal is to provide information and resources to empower others to make the best decision for them and their family. Regarding how many people need it, kind of the question along herd immunity, this is when we do really talk much more about herd immunity. We do believe that somewhere between 60 to 70% of the population needs to have pretty substantial, robust immunity to prevent kind of ongoing transmission across a population as a whole. As long as we have COVID circulating, you know, there likely will be continued movement, but if you've got a population that's got pretty good immunity, it helps to prevent it moving. I kind of think of it like forest fire. If you don't have a lot of kindling, it's hard to have it take off, even if you get one person to get it. Regarding how long the vaccine will last, that we also don't know. So about 6 months into vaccine trials is when we start to see if your body builds, it's what's called innate immunity, this kind of longer T-cell immunity, where it holds on to that immunity for a longer period of time versus needing to get it renewed on a regular basis. And then as mentioned, kind of mutations in the virus, but again, the mutations we've seen in this virus have been very stable for the target. So we are not as really concerned about the mutations at this point. We just want to make sure that the immunity that you build up from the vaccine lasts long enough. And so those are important questions to determine, you know, is this something that's going to need to happen yearly? Is this something that we're going to have to really push out? Our goal is to try to provide as much vaccine to those who want to take it as efficiently and quickly as possible. There are limitations all the way along the process, including how much the companies can literally manufacture, to how much we get as a state, and then getting it out and available. And so those will determine, as well as how long this lasts, as well as what happens with this virus. But the data and science that we're seeing on the immunology of this is incredibly reassuring and optimistic at this point regarding the fact that it looks highly efficacious. And as mentioned, we are getting a kind of a larger dose than we expected in the state initially to help immunize people quickly across the state. Thank you.
And I guess with that question, the Senator Schauer's question as a follow-up, is there a percentage goal of the population that the department would like to reach?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Senator. You know, at first, it would be 100% of what we get because we know that what we get is not going to come anywhere close to the 60 to 70% of what's there. So as we're getting vaccines in, we expect the demand to be much greater than what we have, and so that's where it will initially be. And again, that kind of herd immunity status has reached somewhere between 60, 70% of the population who has some a significant degree of immunity overall. And so our goal continues to be the health and well-being of Alaskans, And the vaccine is one significant tool to get there. Once we get to kind of that percentage of the population, that will be very, very helpful. But we're continuing to learn lots. I think it's just important to remember that we're only a year into this virus, and while things have moved quite quickly, we have learned so much about the immunology of this disease and the response, and we'll continue to follow it closely moving forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, before we go to you, Senator Beckett, just want to make sure we get to Senator Giesel if she has any questions. Oh, never mind. She's maybe have dropped off the line. Senator Beckett, go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify, too. I've heard from constituents as well about concerns about some kind of a mandated vaccine, and I would just point out that as recently as Friday, even the president-elect indicated that there would be no mandated vaccine, and that this really is a matter of, as president-elect put it, asking us to, quote, do the right thing, end quote. So I think all of us should take a moment and just reassure our constituencies that we're not mandating a vaccine. What we're trying to do is ensure that people take a vaccine to stay safe and to keep others safe, and that we're watching the studies, we're watching the work that's done here, and I just really think it's important to reduce the fear levels in the public that somehow big government's going to come in and demand that they do things. You know, if we just are rational, we approach this scientifically, and that I for one will be taking the vaccine when it's available. If we just are rational about this, we can reduce the total number, the concerns that people irrationally have expressed and have been fed by social media. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And again, the committee is not taking an official standpoint on the get the vaccine. We're just trying to provide information for folks to make that individual decision with their healthcare providers. Just want to state that. Dr. Zink, we've heard from a couple of constituents that want to know, is the vaccine in any way going to alter a person's DNA?
Thank you for that question, Senator Chairman. No, the vaccine will not alter your DNA. So the way that your cells work, the DNA is then transcribed into RNA that then makes proteins. This messenger RNA cannot get into the nucleus or the mitochondria where DNA lives. It is a very finicky molecule that quickly dissolves. Dr. Jay Butler described it as M&M's. It's like the chocolate in the middle, and so it has to have a good shell to be able to get in, but then it's quickly broken apart by the body. It does not last for a long time in the body, and that's part of the reason it has to be stored at this negative 70-degree temperature. But it does not alter your DNA. It does not get into the nucleus, and it is quickly destroyed within the body once it starts to make the little proteins that help to kind of give your body the cheat sheet on how to fight against COVID-19.
Thank you. And are the vaccines made from fetal material, the ones that we're getting through our state?
Thank you, Senator. Dr. Ann Zink, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine are not using any fetal cells for the development of this vaccine.
Thank you. And what sort of microchip or tracking may be contained in the vaccine?
Appreciate that question, Senator. There is no microchip. There is no tracking. We really value the privacy and independence, nor would that be a part of a vaccine in general. The CDC will be offering an app where people can monitor their symptoms, but that is as close as any sort of monitoring gets to any of these vaccines.
Okay. Do you have any reason to believe these vaccines may pose a risk to fertility?
Thank you for that question. No, we do not have any concerns about fertility with these vaccines. We continue to follow the safety data closely. This is building on a long history of a previous understanding of both messenger RNA, which is what these vaccines are founded on. We do know that COVID-19 is a vascular disease, and we are seeing increasing data that the disease itself may cause some vascular challenges, which can potentially cause some fertility challenges, and we follow those very closely. We know pregnant women, for example, are more affected by COVID-19 than those who are not, but we do not suspect any challenges with this vaccine regarding fertility, but we'll continue to follow that closely.
Okay. And how likely is someone to have a severe allergic reaction to any of these vaccines?
Appreciate that question. Again, in the first 2 months, we see most of the adverse outcomes. In both groups, we saw no significant allergic reactions or significant side effects with these vaccines. Again, one vaccine trial had over 30,000, one vaccine trial had over 40,000 people that have gone beyond that two-month point at this point to look for any significant serious adverse side effects, and no significant, including no significant allergic reactions were determined. I would also say that the basis of RNA vaccines have been studied for a long time, and in general, they are thought to be incredibly safe vaccines. The challenge with mRNA vaccines has been making them efficacious, making them stable enough to work well. And the slight changes that they were able to make in the stability of the RNA, as well as the way that it kind of is presented to the cell, appears to make these more effective. But in general, mRNA vaccines are thought to be some of the safest vaccine platforms out there.
And I guess with that, are mRNA vaccines sort of a new idea, and how do we know that they're safe?
Fantastic question, Mr. Chairman. They're not a new idea. They've been around for some time. They've been tried with numerous other types of viruses in the past. There's different what we call platforms for vaccine development. However, we have not had a widely spread messenger RNA vaccine in the past, and that has not been because of safety concerns. That has been because of efficacy concerns, being able to have that mRNA stable enough to make it super efficacious, making it work well once it gets in. But they have been studied everything from RSV to HIV to Ebola and continue to follow those vaccines closely. The development that has happened because so much time, effort, scientific technology and money honestly has been spent in trying to understand COVID-19 as well as the virus that causes it. We are seeing just a real growth right now in the vaccine front regarding mRNA vaccines, and I expect this to be a big leap moving forward for additional viruses moving forward.
All right. Thank you. Senator Baggage or Senator Schauer, any other additional questions?
Not at this time.
All right. Senator Schauer?
Can you hear me now? Sorry.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
No more questions. Thank you. Just to apologize. I had it on mute. Forgot to take it off. Thanks.
Not a problem. Well, I just wanted to point out the website here that we have, the covidvax.alaska.gov. That's the site that if folks from the public may want to learn more about some of the opportunities, about the ECHO meeting, about how they can get involved in sort of the providing feedback to the allocation community, about their essential worker needs, or get more information, that's the best website to go to.
Yeah, this is Tessa Walker-Lunderman, and yes, our website, covidvax.alaska.gov, is the best resource for staying up to date on information. We are keeping that updated very regularly.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Zink, Tessa Walker-Lunderman, Matt Bobo, Dr. Anders, and Lori Winghire, thanks for being on. Though you didn't really get to participate much, if you have any questions or things or comments, Director Winghire? Maybe she's on mute.
No, sir, I'm here.
Okay. I just didn't want to leave without asking if you had any comments or things that you may want to input into the information that was provided today.
Senator Wilson, the only thing I can say is that this team has worked incredibly hard to make this vaccine available and to all Alaskans as soon as possible, and I'm incredibly proud of them, and I certainly hope it turns the corner for us when it's available.
All right. Thank you. And, again, the states are working under the federal administration, under Operation Warp Speed, under the Trump administration. And that concludes our business for today. I just want to thank all the committee members and all the other legislators and the public for attending and following along. And this meeting is adjourned at 11:30 a.m.